Welcome to STEMcast, the podcast designed to equip teachers and students focused on communication, science, technology, engineering, and math. Each episode will bring you an inspiring interview and encouraging message to help you prepare for a better tomorrow. Join us as we believe everyone is an artist and an engineer. Here's your host, Dr. Reagan Flowers.
All right. I have with me another awesome individual joining us today for our STEMcast podcast. Today I have Scott Beminick. Did I pronounce that correctly, Scott, your last name?
It's close. It's actually Beminick.
Beminick. I love it. Okay. Was that better?
Yes, very good. Thank you.
Awesome. Well, Scott Beminick is a scientist and an author doing some amazing work in the space of STEM. And as all the listeners know, I'm always excited to connect with everyone or share everyone with awesome people, people who are doing some extraordinary work and people who can inspire and help, you know, progress the work that they're doing in the space of STEM, particularly in education and inspiring our next generation of leaders. And so with that, Scott, thank you for joining us today. And we can begin this segment with you sharing with the listeners a little detail about your career journey, which I find so fascinating, to where you started to where you are today.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. Yeah, so I mean, after high school, I grew up in a very small town, some 5,000 people. I mean, it was a great experience growing up, you know, great educational system, actually. And so after high school, I decided I wanted to go to college, taking actually quite a bit of science and mathematics. In high school, we had some great teachers, and they were very encouraging, very engaging. I think it makes a huge difference. So I went on to college at a small school, actually, in Waukesha, Wisconsin, pretty close to my house, Carroll College. I guess now it's Carroll University. And I obtained my bachelor's degree in chemistry and physics. So after those 4 years, I decided that I wanted to keep pursuing sciences and mathematics, and I went on to graduate school. So I attended the University of Kansas, KU, in Lawrence, and obtained a PhD. And again, in chemistry, it's actually a specific area called theoretical or physical chemistry. It deals with a lot of, so I think when people think of chemists, they often think of the person who goes into the lab and mixes things up and things like that. That's not the chemist I am. My skills don't belong in the lab.
I'm glad you cleared that up.
Yeah, well, no, it's good that I realized this. I should have realized it a lot sooner, but I eventually did realize that my skills, my love for science was, you know, true, but my skills weren't in the lab, and so I pursued theoretical chemistry, which is kind of a combination of chemistry and physics and mathematics. And you're doing more, you know, analytical type work, working with computers, maybe you're just working, you know, with paper and pencil, things like that, but you're definitely not in the lab. So I went on and got a PhD in that at University of Kansas. And then, then it comes that time where you're trying to figure out, you know, what are you going to do? Are you going to continue kind of the educational process? Are you going to get a job? And I was a little bit uncertain, you know, as to that, but I was fortunate that after graduate school, actually awarded a National Research Council Fellowship, and I joined the Army Research Labs in Aberdeen, Maryland, and, you know, did some interesting things there. So my background was, you know, a lot of computer simulation and modeling techniques. And so I modeled, you know, things that were interesting to the Army. You know, of course, those things are explosive. That's, you know, that's mostly what the Army wants you to model. They think about these things quite a bit. It was a nice opportunity because it's one of these very interesting systems, I think, from a science point of view. These are very obviously dynamical systems, but you can't easily go into the laboratory and study these systems for, you know, obvious reasons. But on a computer, you can really get a lot of insight into the chemistry and the physics that's going on. And so I think it was a real nice opportunity there. And then after that, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, this whole military thing is quite intriguing, but no, please go ahead. We'll go back to that.
Okay, good. Yeah, sure. Yeah, you can stop me anytime. So after that, I actually thought about staying there. They had offered me, you know, they'd offered me a job after my 2 year fellowship. It was a great group of people. I learned a lot of nice things, did some really exciting work. But I kind of was leaning towards, at that time at least, going into academics. I thought that, you know, I wanted to take up a position somewhere at a university or college and teach and do research. I realized what that really meant is, you know, going back into that environment. And so what I did is another postdoctorate, or I became a research associate at Colorado State University in Fort Collins, Colorado. Worked for a great guy there for 2 years. Once again, you know, studying very interesting systems, you know, using computers and computer simulation techniques. He was actually trained as a physicist, and we spent a lot of time in what I like to call old school paper and pencil work. You know, you're working out these equations and all these things, and you're thinking very hard about this stuff. and as well as doing the computer simulations. I mean, in fact, I still remember the last paper that we wrote was 6 pages, but the actual derivations, the paper pencil stuff was 300 pages. It was really exciting work, and I really enjoyed that 2 years there. And then it was really time to find a job. You know, and I struggled, like I said, I struggled a lot with, you know, going into academics or, you know, going into industry. And what I decided to do and the opportunity just kind of, things just kind of came together. I joined Johnson & Johnson and their computer-aided drug discovery group here in San Diego, California. That was back in 2002, and I've been here ever since.
Wow. So several things. This is great. Your story is amazing. Well, want to start with, you come from a small town. You mentioned 5,000 people. And we work with some schools, actually, in a CSTEM program that are in the Wisconsin, I guess, Milwaukee area that participate in our program.
I was born in Milwaukee, actually.
Okay. All right. But I understand small town living, you know, born in Detroit, but I was raised in Mississippi, in the Delta, Cleveland, Mississippi. And so I understand populations of 5,000. It's a small area and you're hungry to get out, right? And to see this big world that's out there. And so I find that interesting. So what was the size of your high school graduating class?
We were pretty small, you know, around over 100. Yeah, 100, 150.
Okay, yeah. Okay, yeah, that was like, we were 100, I believe, exactly. And it was quite entertaining when I got to college. I don't know if you had that experience, but people would talk about, oh, yeah, top 10% of my class or, you know, the head. And I said, yeah, I was too, you know, and you said, what's your class size? Well, it's 100. Like, oh, well, really? Yeah, I'm sure you were the top 10%. It was only 100 of you guys. So no real bragging rights with those coming from, you know, graduating classes, you know, in the upper hundreds, you know? Yeah. So yeah, I mean,
that's a great, I remember I had some more experience too, you know, and I think part of that's why, you know, I went to a smaller school, you know, Carroll College. At the time that I went was only 1,500 people roughly. So I think that I was still kind of looking for, obviously, the college experience, but still kind of that smaller feel. You know, so I think it influences you in a lot of different ways. I mean, actually, it's funny. I only applied to two schools. Carroll College, that's where my chemistry teacher from high school went. and then I applied to the University of Madison, Wisconsin, which at that time was like 40, 50,000 people. I got accepted to both, and you know, for whatever reasons, and I think part of it was that small town or that small feel, if you will. I went to Carroll College.
Mm-hmm. Got it. And then you're at Johnson & Johnson. I have a good friend who started his career, chemistry background as well. He's in the Philadelphia area. His stage name is Grand Hank, but his name that his mother gave him is Tyrone Bagdale, but he started there as a chemist, and he travels the world doing a hip-hop chemistry-infused type show with children. It's pretty outstanding, but it started right there at Johnson & Johnson, so I'll have to make certain I connect you guys, because there may be some synergies, particularly what you're doing with your children's book.
Yeah, please do. That sounds exciting.
Yeah. So tell the listeners here, you know, you've got this really awesome background and interesting path that you've taken, and particularly when you talk about dynamics of explosives with the military, that's enough to excite a lot of children. The reason they love going into a chemistry classroom is so that they can have something, you know, mix chemicals to cause a chemical reaction that is exciting and explodes and, you know, bubbles over. So definitely what gets kids excited about science, one of the things. But during this path of, you know, your journey, and it's been one of lots of hard work and perseverance to be where you are today and to make the best strategic decisions, you know, regarding your career to be where you are today. Can you share, you know, you mentioned earlier you had this interest in math and science. You did well in math and science early on, and you were able to identify that and figure it out. But is there anything else in particular? Was there an experience of some sort that you had that really inspired this path? Was there a teacher? Was there an participation in a program, a fair, or some type of experiential thing that just really, you know, got your wheels going?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think there were several things. I mean, I can remember early on just being interested in how things work, right? So, I mean, as a small child, I would take things apart and attempt to put them back together, much to the dismay of my mom, although she was very supportive. But, I always kind of had this ongoing little projects, you know, doing this and that. And in particular, I had an interest in, I think, in medicine and things like this, you know. So I remember being a kid, going to the bathroom, into the medicine cabinet, you know, mixing this with that, trying this and that, doing little experiments. So I think it started pretty early on, just this kind of a very general, what I like to think of as this interest in science and that. You know, when I got to school, in particular high school, I had some great teachers, you know, and I have to really give a shout out to my chemistry teacher, Mrs. Serpy, actually. She was a fantastic teacher. You know, she offered, we had 3 years of chemistry, actually, you know, which I think is very impressive for, you know, growing up in such a small town and going to what is a small high school. We had 3 years of fantastic chemistry.
Well, I have to just jump in there. Someone figured things out at your high school. 3 years of chemistry. I am very impressed. You don't see that too often nowadays in a lot of schools.
No, it was amazing. And for me, that was really, I mean, it was easily a game changer. I mean, the teacher herself was very, very smart, very impressive. I mean, she had a great dynamic. I mean, she could really build that rapport with the students. She could explain this, you know, these very difficult things in a very comprehensible way. And it made a difference, you know, and yeah, 3 years of chemistry, you know, all the way through AP chemistry, took the AP test, did all those things. And it was fantastic. And I think that was, that was a game changer for me. I mean, she definitely inspired me and why I probably in part I became a chemist, to be honest with you. And went on to college after that. My advisor was a fantastic chemistry professor. He really kind of took me under his wing and really did some fantastic things in chemistry, but also in mathematics. And I don't know, looking back, if I wouldn't have really, you know, ran into this person, I think I would have still gone on to graduate school. It would not have been for theoretical chemistry, which would have been a mistake. You know, I think these people, they not only encourage you and also get you excited about this material, they really help you see what it is you should be doing, you know, or what your real passion is and also how to pursue it. So, you know, I was very fortunate.
Well, help us understand, you know, we talk about going off to college. What are you going to study? What are you going to major? You know, we're talking to kids and if they want to study chemistry, do they just, and you know, they go in there as a major, the major is chemistry. And you enlightened me today in reference to this space of theoretical chemistry. And you're the first theoretical chemist I've met. So I would love, you know, share with our teachers, our listeners, the kids, how do you happen upon this major? Is this something that is unique? This course of study at certain universities or all universities that offer chemistry programs?
Yeah, when I went to college, so, you know, even in middle school and high school, I always really enjoyed mathematics and the sciences. And then it got more well-defined when I went to high school. You know, I still loved math. I mean, I took all the math that we had, which at the time was all the way through calculus. And I took, in addition to 3 years of chemistry, we only had a year of physics, but I took that as well, and 3 years of biology. I took all our sciences and mathematics. You know, it wasn't clear to me exactly, obviously, when I went to college, what I was going to do. And when I got there, I thought I was going to do biochemistry or do both chemistry and biology at the same time. And then it became clear that chemistry was still on my list, but biology was not. That wasn't something I really wanted to do. And so after my first year, I dropped that. It took a while. But once again, it was really connecting up with Dr. Washington, who was a very inspiring professor at Carroll College at the time. You know, it became clear to me that I could really leverage, you know, not only my love of chemistry and physics, but also the mathematics and bring it together. And that's what really theoretical chemistry was. And I wasn't even thinking of that at all. I knew I wanted to do chemistry. I'd always had a love of mathematics, but that had kind of dwindled a little bit in college for a variety of different reasons. But I still had that passion for chemistry. This person, Dr. Washington, I mean, he just made it clear to me you didn't have to give up any of these things. You could bring them together, you know, the chemistry, the physics, and the mathematics. And you could go on to graduate school and do these things and do some exciting work. You know, it's exciting to be able to leverage all these areas.
That is exciting. And with that, let's talk a little bit about this science book. And now this, is it The Cosmic Machine?
Yeah, that's right. The Cosmic Machine.
And
this science that runs our universe and the story behind it.
Yes. And so with this, tell us about this book. What is it that you hope the readers, what are some of the things you hope the readers get after having read your book?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a great question. You know, I wrote the book, it's actually really a combination of a science and a science history book. I struggled with, you know, I think we all know how difficult science can be sometimes to really convey and really engage people with. I think science in general is interesting, but I think that the presentation often, you know, it's a challenging subject. And I think that sometimes the presenters have some challenges as well. What I'm hoping to do is really what I like to do is I call it a science story. So I really develop, you know, I talk about a lot of the history. I talk about some of the very interesting scientists like Einstein and Galileo that we're familiar with, but also other scientists that I think people would find interesting, but they, you know, they probably have never heard of. And of course, in addition to all of that, I wrap that story and, you know, I wrap the science into that story. So it's So I'm hoping that what people, I hope they obviously learn some science. I hope it's very tractable to people that don't necessarily have a science background. But, if nothing else, I think that they'll find the biographical information about some of these scientists actually very fascinating. I think that, scientists are just, they're regular people. They have the struggles that everybody else, they have the things, the personal things, and challenges, I think, for the most part. They're just working on different problems. I don't know if people have an understanding of that. And I think sometimes they kind of miss that connection. So I'm hoping that people feel more connected to the scientists and the science in general, learn some very interesting science and enjoy what I think is a very fascinating, great story.
Well, I have to ask, is there anything in this book about Da Vinci?
Well, that's a great question. It's funny you should ask that. I struggled with how to fit him in. I carved out certain topics in that. The short answer is no. But the reality is, this guy was a fascinating guy, right? He hardly ever slept. He contributed to, art and science. I think alone he could be his, maybe that should be the second book.
Yeah.
the guy was amazing. And it's funny you bring it up because I was actually recently looking at some of his pictures. And he was just amazing.
Yes, yes. I am just in love with Da Vinci. It's our tagline with C-STEM, as everyone is an artist and an engineer, we believe it's a little Da Vinci in everyone. And so when you talk about the science story, behind, the book, The Cosmic Machine, and you're really, hoping that people glean the human side of scientists is one of the things in reading your book. And you think about someone as with such an amazing, brilliant mind as a Da Vinci, that's definitely such great stories to share about his human side and his struggles and his merging of the world of art and science. It's so intriguing. So your book is something that I find, to be very interesting and definitely of need to really connect the human side to science and something that could really supplement classroom teaching, today. And I guess I'd also like to say in supplementing classroom teaching of today, when I engage with a lot of children, that one of their desires is often a connecting with modern day scientists, not scientists of old. And so with your book, how well do you do there with connecting children, these stories, the science stories to modern day scientists?
I think it's pretty good. As we talk about, obviously, the scientists that people are very familiar with, like Einstein and these people, I do mention, some of the more modern day scientists that are doing some very interesting things. I think of, personally, I'm a big fan of, there's several physicists I'm a big fan, so I talk about a little bit of, I only briefly mentioned some of Ryan Green's work, the superstring theories and things like that. A lot of the book is actually committed to talking more about the, what I think are kind of the more fundamental or kind of what I think of the pillars of science, like things like atoms and energy and, even entropy and quantum mechanics, these things. So a lot of time is spent kind of building what I think is the foundation of science, talking about the major contributors there. And I think that really forms kind of very interesting stories because I think people can kind of see. They also get insight to, why these people were thinking about these things. I think sometimes science seems very abstract to non-scientists because they're even wondering, why in my daily life would I even be thinking about this stuff? I think that the book goes a long way in trying to make that kind of human connection as well.
Yes, I really like that in terms of the why behind the science, right? It's funny how, some things come about in science. We sometimes it's by pure accident.
Well, that's right.
Yeah.
Or sometimes you're trying to answer a totally, totally different question.
Mm-hmm.
Atoms, we understand atoms as far as making up matter and depth, which is something that started way back when the Greek philosophers were thinking about, very different things.
Mm-hmm.
They were thinking about the nature of change and the nature of, permanent things, permanency as they called it, in nature and trying to really understand those things. They weren't thinking at the time so much about, the atom and electrons and all these things as we understand it today. So I think that, understanding some of the roots, where these things came from is, I think it's really important, because I think it gives a perspective, a more humanistic perspective.
Yes, you've got me thinking back to my classroom teaching days when I was teaching biology, and that's more my area of specialization. And I think about, the discovery of penicillin. It definitely was not anything that they were sitting out to discover. And it's, surely, by accident and how these things, take place. But it's the discovery of a bacteria that leads to a drug that is still used today in a very meaningful way, you know, to cure illness. And so that's fascinating. And that piece of what you are doing with your book. Now, you're aware, I know, of our program in terms of we're creating a new curriculum that we involve kids with every year. And this year, the theme is the Urban Nexus. And I always like to get some perspective from our persons who are guests on our podcast regarding what the kids are working on. And so can you share anything that comes to your mind in association with the theme, the Urban Nexus, improving the quality of life?
I mean, that's a good question. So I think being, well, there's a few things. Being connected to, obviously, I'm in the healthcare industry, and I think a lot about, you know, health challenges that we have and just physical fitness and things like that in general. And, you know, one of the things I think about is kind of just, you know, improving your quality of life through kind of a healthy lifestyle. I would kind of think like a healthy lifestyle challenge, you know, for children and that. Because I think about, you know, let's be honest, these days, you know, kids are, I don't think they're quite as active as they used to be. And we have some of these challenges. I was kind of reading some articles recently and just thinking about it. I was actually surprised to learn that, it was a learning thing for me, that, you know, children are spending almost, you know, 7-8 hours looking at the TV or playing a video game or on the computer. And while there's obviously sometimes value in that, it's a little bit, you know, dismaying, you know, that 7-8 hours of our day is like this. And, you know, being in the healthcare profession, we talk a lot about prevention. You know, there's, you know, by the time you actually unfortunately end up with a certain condition or that, obviously, if you're lucky and fortunate, these days we have a lot of treatment in that. There's really nothing better than prevention, you know, and I think about prevention in terms of physical fitness and just healthy eating and things like that, a healthy lifestyle. So I think in some ways, improving quality of life, you'd have to definitely put in kind of a healthy lifestyle challenge.
You know, we have not talked about that with any of the other guests on the show. And I really appreciate on the podcast that, you know, I appreciate you bringing that up, because something that comes to my mind that we could have touched on, or that the students might be possibly touching on as they're currently working on these projects across the nation, there could be some looking at healthy lifestyles and how that's impacted in urban spaces. Because as we look at urban spaces becoming more crowded, more saturated, more construction, less land space available for farming or growing crops, or even just having enough trees planted, you know, in these spaces to support having adequate green spaces in communities, it affects how healthy they can be, because they'll have to take extra steps, right? You know, right. When then there's more concrete, there's less green space, there's less places to get out and get active and exercise and just really enjoy the great outdoors. There's less space, you know, to really plant those gardens. And so that means importing more things that are processed and prepackaged and, you know, a more restricted engagement in physical activity. And so that's something that, you know, has never come up on any of these segments. So I really appreciate you bringing that in, because it just does allow us to look at it from a different perspective. You know, we talk a lot about the Urban Nexus and how it's and improving the quality of life with regard to, you know, infrastructure issues and transportation, energy, you know, water, things of that nature. But we hadn't talked about it in terms of its impact on a healthy lifestyle and how do we ensure that we're supporting a healthy lifestyle with all of the growth that we're seeing in urban spaces around the world. So I really appreciate you bringing that up there. This is why you've got to have all these amazing conversations with all these different people with amazing, brilliant minds, because you bring a different perspective that you might not think of otherwise. And so we have talked, you know, no problem. You have, you know, you've shared about, you know, you've had a supportive mother, you had great teachers in high school, you had great college advisor that really helped to steer you in the right direction, as well as support you down this path of where you are today. Are there any types of resources that were particularly helpful to you, or any resources that you would like to recommend for those who may be interested in the work that you're doing that they should possibly check out, or that have been really instrumental in some point down your path?
That's a good question. I mean, I'm not sure if it's, you know, for me, it wasn't any one thing in particular. You know, it was really, I was fortunate to, well, they have a good education system when I was in middle school and high school, and to have these mentors. But I think that people can do, you know, there's a lot people can do on their own, really kind of take ownership of their own education. I think a big thing is really just kind of what I like to call this kind of constantly learning, you know, mindset. You know, education, as you know, obviously doesn't stop after school or even when you leave school, if you're still in school. It's really about, you know, maybe you have a side project or maybe you have something that you're just interested in. You know, maybe you're just, I mean, for example, well, let me give you an example to kind of clarify this. When I was in high school, in addition to the math and science classes that I enjoyed, I went to that magnificent chemistry teacher that we talked about earlier. And I said, well, is there anything else that I can do? You know, I'm interested in these things. And could we kind of tailor a project, you know, for me? And she said, absolutely. I actually did what they called, it was an independent research project. They called it a quest back then. And I think that's a great name for it. And it was in collaboration with the chemistry teacher and also the biology teacher. And we came up with this, it was called chemical mixtures effective against fish diseases of all things, which you can see kind of this tie back to kind of an early interest, if you will, in medicine. I think there are resources. I think there's people out there. I think educators, and approach them with an idea, you know, don't put the burden just on them. Approach them, you know, maybe you have an idea. Maybe you've been doing a side project at home. You need a little mentoring and tutoring. You know, I think there's people in the educational system or at a university or even in industry. For example, I know that, you know, where I work, and I know this is like this at many places, we have, you know, maybe a summer internship. Or if you can't get a summer internship, then volunteer. You know, I've never known too many people to turn away volunteers. You know, it's obviously, you know, you probably won't get paid, but it's a great opportunity. In some ways, I would say it's better you don't get paid, you know, because you're really taking ownership of that opportunity to learn something, you know, pretty fantastic in a lot of cases.
Good points that you make. You mentioned you went to a great school and you knew that you went to a great school. I am really impressed that you were aware at that time that you were at a great school and you took advantage of the opportunities that the school provided you, which it speaks a lot to your character, your value system, and just knowing, you know, how to be present to take advantage of that which can propel you for what's next in your life. And you've touched on, you know, the point of knowing that education, you know, just it didn't stop post high school and it's not even stopping for you post college. And the value of taking advantage of internships, you know, whether they're paid and unpaid. And all of those things are just so awesome and it's dynamic and it's great when things line up in that way. But then I look at, you know, children who they're not necessarily in the best education system. They know they're not in the best education system and they're trying to take advantage of the opportunities that are there and they're doing that which is presented to them. And it might not be necessarily setting them up for success without them even realizing it because, you know, they're at the school they're at and they've not had an experience outside of that school to know, you know, whether they're getting what's needed and what's going to set them up to be competitive or not. Is there anything that you would say, I guess, you know, to a child in terms of it may know that they're not at the best school, but they want to be you when they grow up? Are there some things that you would encourage them to do where they can take ownership of their destiny and their learning to make certain that they're able to go to a Carroll College or university and someday work at a Johnson & Johnson? Is there anything you could say or share that may help them be intrinsically motivated to do the extra that's going to help them get there?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, it's a tough question. I mean, I think about, you know, when I started out, it's actually kind of, you know, an interesting story. When I was younger, I actually wasn't so often that I wasn't even regularly attending school up until I got to high school. So I spent a lot of time, my educational process was, well, missing school, and then my mother would go pick up the lesson plans from the teachers, and I would work through it. And that was kind of my education for such a big chunk that in fourth grade, they actually were going to hold me back, not because I wasn't doing what I was, but by state law, you got to actually attend school a certain number of days to pass. And I'm grateful that the teacher and I had a very, very persuasive mother. They agreed that you can't, you know, hold this kid back because he's actually doing well, and it would just really demotivate him. So, I mean, I can kind of appreciate, you know, some of the challenges. I mean, I was very fortunate because, like you pointed out, I had mentors and things, but I had some challenges too. I think you need to, in some ways, you kind of need to call upon yourself to kind of engage in some of these things and just kind of push it through. You know, I think that if you basically preparing yourself for an opportunity, right? I think that, you know, sometimes you're looking for the opportunity and it's not there. I think that's what you're pointing out. And then So what do you do then? You know, what do you do when it's not there? What I think that all you can do is you keep looking, like I think most people do. But at the same time, you're preparing yourself for it. You know, whether that means you're at home teaching yourself things, you know, because you're missing school, or what, maybe you have a side project, or maybe you're, you know, just reading, you know, at this feverish pace to take in a whole bunch of knowledge. I think that the process is one of where you're preparing yourself for the opportunity when it's not there, and you're continuing to look for it. That, and I think it will happen. You know, I think that, you know, in a lot of ways I was fortunate, but I think it was a combination of kind of being ready for the opportunity. And because you can't see the opportunity if you're not ready for it. You know, I think people also do need to feel free to, you know, engage, you know, their teachers or other people, or maybe professional people that they know. And there's nothing wrong with kind of putting these people on the spot and saying, is there anything else I can do? And I think you'd be surprised to see how many people would actually help out, you know, but I think it's a combination of these things, you know, preparing yourself, looking for the opportunities, you know, feeling that you can engage some of these people and not being discouraged if, you know, this person turns you away. You got to keep kind of pushing through it, because there will be someone, you know, that will take an interest and give you kind of that extra guidance if you need it. You know, if you have these other things in place, they'll see it in you, I think.
Well, Scott, you just said something that I felt it was very powerful. You said you've got to be ready for the opportunity, because if you keep looking and you keep doing, but if you're not ready for the opportunity, you cannot receive the opportunity. And sometimes we don't know that we're not ready for the opportunity, because, you know, we think we've prepared ourselves and we've done the work that's necessary. And you're saying, well, gosh, I thought I would be here, or I'll be able to do this, but you couldn't recognize the opportunity when it was presented to you because you weren't ready to receive it. And so it's all about the developmental stages of processes of preparedness and your understanding, and when in getting yourself ready to receive information, right, so that you can take advantage of it. So that within itself is very powerful. And with that, you mentioned earlier, you know, summer internships, whether they're paid or unpaid. And I think, you know, that goes, you know, that is something that's so important. And I push internships all the time. You know, CSTEM has an internship program for undergraduate to graduate level students. And even with my niece, who's currently in college, you know, I'm pushing, you know, you've got to get these internships, because you've got to have this work experience, you know, before you get this degree, because that's what's going to make you that much more marketable. It's beyond just getting that piece of paper. But what you find is that a lot of, you know, the children, whether they're high school or college age, a lot of them are having to work, and they're having to try to balance that. And so when you mention to them an unpaid internship, it's like, oh God, no, I've got to work, I've got to get paid, or I need an internship that is paid. And of course, paid internships are a lot more competitive, and there are a lot less of those out there. And so I think it's also, when you're talking about being ready for the opportunity, it's, you know, sometimes you've got to put in a lot more hours and a lot more time to prepare yourself, you know, for what could be possible and greater for you later in life. And that might mean an unpaid internship and negotiating, you know, can it be one day out of the week or two or 3 days where you can work your job as well as have that internship, of being creative about it, right?
I think that's the point. I totally agree. I mean, that's a great point, because I think that, of course, everybody wants that great internship where they get to experience, they get the decent pay and all these things, but these are becoming fewer and, you know, and fewer, right? Or if they even exist anymore, I'm not sure. But because I just remember how rare it was, you know, now these things, imagine how much more difficult it is now. But, you know, you have to be willing to do the unpaid internship or to volunteer. I think the opportunities are there, you know, and but don't get frustrated if you're not seeing them. You've got to constantly kind of keep your own skill set, you know, up enough. You know, you have to kind of, there's always opportunities. I always think it was kind of a back and forth where you're looking for the opportunities, and during those harder times where maybe they're not there, you know, go back, and there's always opportunities to learn yourself. You know, you can do the stuff. The opportunities, you know, will arise, but you also have to be willing to maybe lower the bar, like you're pointing out. You know, you may not get that wonderful paying summer internship with that, but there may just be this great volunteer opportunity that you could learn as much or even more. It probably will be actually a better growing experience.
Exactly. That's great points you make. Volunteering is also that option. You know, when it's unpaid, you're definitely volunteering your time. But you're volunteering your time in a way that you have something to add to your resume that speaks specifically to, you know, real work experience that is connected to your specialization with your degree. And so it's really critical. I wanted to go back here as I'm looking at that, the time here, and I want to make certain we are definitely sharing as much as we need to regarding the cosmic machine. And would like for you to take this opportunity to share anything else you'd like the listeners to know about this amazing book.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, it's been a big journey. It's funny, when I started out, you know, so I started thinking about this idea back in 2009, and then I started really writing, really putting down the words in 2010. I was so convinced, you know, I could wrap this up in about 2 years. This all started with, you know, actually a very simple conversation with a friend. She had read a popular science book. I don't even remember the book or the author. It's not really too important. But what was great is my friend, who really doesn't have a science background, was talking about this book and just how, you know, enlightening it was, how excited she was to learn these things about these scientists and the science. And it really struck me. It really made me think this was something that, you know, I'd like to do, that perhaps I could do and really get people engaged, like, you know, I was seeing her be engaged by this author. So this started back in 2009. I started writing in 2010. I was so convinced that I could wrap this up in 2 years. And, you know, 2 years became three, and three became four. And, you know, and so I'm expecting that now I'm going to release it fall of this year. But it's been quite a journey. I've really enjoyed it because, you know, the goal, like we talked earlier, was really to make, you know, some of the, what I think are the most important areas of science accessible to people that maybe don't have a science background. And even if they do, I think there's a lot in there, you know, for the science savvy, you know. And so, I mean, for me personally, it's been a great journey because I think I've really grown as a scientist. You know, when you spend your time talking to other scientists, that's a certain type of interaction and engagement. But you know, it's funny, scientists, we kind of have our vocabulary. We have the words that we use and the things that we just understand that we don't even have to say to each other. You know, and that, of course, when you're talking to non-scientists, that's not really how I think you want to talk to non-scientists, because those aren't, it's not their vocabulary. Those aren't the common thoughts that they have. And so I spent a lot of time really trying to, I guess for me personally, rework my vocabulary, you know, think about how would you explain things like an atom or, you know, an electron to someone that's never thought too much about these things, you know, things that scientists in our field take for granted every day. And so I spent a lot of time just trying to break this down into, you know, kind of a common vocabulary, if you will, that would allow people without a science background, I think, really enjoy science. You know, and like we talked about, there's a lot in there about the scientists themselves, you know, these, you know, struggling through things just like many people are. You know, you talked about, you know, how does one find the opportunities or when they're not around? And I think about, you know, some scientists that kind of struggle through these things. You know, I mean, I don't know if you know, I'm sure you know Michael Faraday. I don't know if you know his story. I don't want to run out of time here, but I think it's really fascinating because this guy was, you know, he grew up in the slums of London in extreme poverty. You know, he had no formal education. He started out as a bookbinder, and he started teaching himself everything. So he's sitting day after day with all these books. He's a bookbinder. He's reading all these books on science and math. He's very, very excited. And he's just taking it in. And then one day decided that I want to be a scientist. Well, but I have no formal education. I've grown up in extreme poverty, and I'm sitting here today as a bookbinder. What do I do? So what did he do? He wrote to the top scientists of the day at the Royal Institute in London. And he basically said, are you looking for an assistant? And this guy was, I don't know, he was very fortunate. I mean, this talks about opportunities, but it also shows you that he made himself ready for the opportunity. He had been educating himself at the best that he could. He had been reading all these books, and this guy took him on. This guy, Davy, took Faraday on as an assistant, and Faraday was able to work himself up to the top ranks in science. So I think, you know, there's opportunity. And I think that, and I think these are some of the things I talk about, some of these scientists and some of the science that they did. I talk about this in the book.
You know what we have not talked about? It's really this 2 to 3 year journey of this self-imposed deadline of getting this book done. And we have to put these deadlines out there for ourselves to reach our goals. But how do you manage, you know, sometimes we can beat ourselves up, right? You know, it's your idea to write the book, it's your idea, you know, transform lives with this amazing science story. And you put a deadline out there and, you know, it may start as 1 year, two, and then it's three. And it's like, my goodness. And you're beating yourself up because you're also doing this in conjunction with, you know, working, traveling and presenting and doing research and dealing with family and just real life. And you're trying to get all this in, you know, at the same time. So how are you balancing, you know, the self-imposed deadline? Because it's just amazing. I don't think we stop long enough to just say, oh, it's amazing. Just the fact that I want to write the book and even that which I have accomplished. And, you know, no, I may not have met my year one or my year two deadline, but it's still amazing that I'm doing this. So how are you keeping yourself inspired and motivated and not beating yourself up about it?
Well, no, I mean, that's a great question. It's kind of been kind of a roller coaster. I mean, you kind of go through these periods of, you know, you missed that original deadline of 2 years or whatever, and you try to ask yourself, what happened? You know, and I think a lot of what happened is, well, like you say, life happens, you know, because you are working, you know, you have a family, you're also working in that, and you have to acknowledge that. Another big part is, you know, I wanted, as I started writing, you know, I had an original idea for the book, and then as it started evolving, it's, you know, I think it's a very dynamical process. And so I started seeing one, oh, I should have this in here. I should talk about this guy, or I should talk about this scientist, and I should tell this story. You know, deadlines are definitely important, you know, and when you miss them, you need to say, well, what happened? Is it just kind of coasting and I missed it, or did I sleep through it, or was it you know, that's not really accessible, right? But I think if you're missing a deadline because you have these other things that you're balancing, or you're really simply trying to improve, you know, whatever you're working on, you're trying to improve it, take it to that next level, you know, that's really genuinely what's happening. You know, I think you got to give yourself a little bit of a break. I say that, and I want people to really hear it. I'm not good at it because every time I missed a deadline, I was really frustrated. You know, I sat down and said, geez, what are you doing? And it's like, how did you miss it? What happened? You're on track. No, what happens is, you know, I think a project grows, it evolves, and that's a good thing. And you need to really take pause and acknowledge that and give yourself a break because, you know, that allows you to take it to the next level. You know, you do want to make certain deadlines, and then other ones maybe you can be flexible on because you're building something that's hopefully, you know, very good. It's a constant, you know, I struggle with it. I like to, you know, I'm a guy that keeps a list. I project out a timeline. About, okay, here's how it's going to go. And I don't know if it ever really goes that way, but it's good to kind of have that image or, you know, that ideal image, if you will, in your mind. But you need to have that. But at the same time, you know, when it's actually warranted knowledge, you need to give yourself a break. You know, if you're trying to take something to another level, well, that takes more time. That takes maybe more research, you know, and things like that. It's a constant balancing and I think a little bit of a struggle in some ways, but it's a good process. You know, it's a good process.
Scott, I really appreciate you sharing that. You know, there's always that balance that, you know, the work-life balance, right? And it's something we're just moving the balls around, you know, trying to make things happen. And I appreciate you being, you know, transparent here in this process because there are listeners who are thinking of writing a book or in the process of writing a book or working on a project or starting a business and or, you know, a kid who wanted to create or invent something or was going to create a project or do something for school and the deadlines have been missed or where they thought they would be at this point in time, they're not. But it's okay. It's embracing the journey and, you know, the process that it takes because how you might start out with an idea, it evolves into something else. And a lot of it is to start, you know, just start the doing. And then through the doing, other, you know, things open up in your mind and your thinking that gives your project more shape or more form or that, you know, just changes things altogether. So thank you for being transparent because, you know, that makes you human. And for others, it's that what they need to feel like it's okay to be where they are and it's, and that they will, you know, inevitably make it to where they're trying to go.
Well, yeah. And I think another thing is, you know, you're going to get frustrated and you're going to want to quit. So for the sake of transparency, I mean, there were many times I just wanted to throw in the towel and say, you know, okay, it's gone on too long. It's too hard. I said 2 years, 3 years, I missed my deadline. And which you started out maybe extremely passionate about and you had all these, you know, visions for and all these things that you thought were going to happen. And you come upon these hard times, you know, for whatever reason, the deadline's getting too stretched or you got other things going on. You know, you just feel like you just want to say, okay, this is, you know, too hard. I can't do it no more. Just, I got to stop. But I would say that don't, because that's a temporary state. You know, I think the people, I'm speaking personally here. I mean, you find yourself in this state and it feels like, oh, this is going to last forever, but it's not going to. Sometimes you just need the grit and the fortitude to push through it because the realization is that that's actually part of the process. I think we forget that, almost forsaking the project, you know, wanting to give up and throw in the towel, but just don't. I don't know what else to say. Don't do it because it'll come to that point where you'll see kind of the light, as they say, up in the tunnel and you'll be able to move past it, you know.
That's well said. And final question of the day here. How do you define success?
Well, I mean, I think that for me personally, success is moving forward, moving beyond where you started. You know, we talked a lot today about, you know, people maybe starting out at a point where, you know, you don't really have all the opportunities. Maybe there's not people there to mentor you. Maybe you don't have the best education. Maybe you have other struggles than that. But I think that personally, success, you know, for me, it's not about making a lot of money. Everybody wants some sort of economic success, of course. But for me, success is really about taking that difficult starting point, if you will, and going past it, moving past it. You know, to overcome that point, to get to the goals and the things that you really, you know, saw yourself doing. You know, maybe that was going to college or graduate school or pursuing science or whatever. But I think that, you know, falling upon a difficult point or even a hardship and moving past it to grow, I think that's success.
Well said, Scott. I'm really appreciative of your time and sharing of your talents and your journey to where you are today. We will be looking out for the Cosmic Science, the Science Story this fall. And we hope that you keep us updated and posted so that we can be sure to share with everyone how they can get access to a copy of this wonderful book that is going to be coming out this fall. And we just thank you. We thank you so much for sharing your story. And as I know, it is inspiring, not just to me, but to our listeners.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity to share.
Very welcome.
Thank you for joining us today. We would like to thank Verizon Wireless for sponsoring the STEMcast episode. If you enjoyed the episode, please leave a review on iTunes. And don't forget to visit our website at cstem-break.ning.com.